This is case 63274, Malcolm Manning versus the State of Nevada. Are counsel ready to proceed? Okay, great.
May it please the Court, Justice Cherry, Justice Hardesty, and Justice Douglas. I'm Deborah Westbrook from the Clark County Public Defender's Office, and I represent Malcolm Manning. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. At approximately 5 p.m. on January 29, 2013, the jury foreman delivered a note to Judge Walsh seeking advice because the jury was deadlocked 10-2 in favor of conviction. The court did not initially tell either party about the note. Instead, Judge Walsh waited until after three guilty verdicts were read the following afternoon. At that point, Judge Walsh told the parties that she had, quote, simply asked the bailiff to tell the jury to come back tomorrow. They're going to have to keep working, unquote. At the court's direction, the bailiff, known as Deputy Diamond, walked into the jury room wearing his tan marshal's uniform with his badge and a gun, and he orally instructed the jury. Deputy Diamond's instructions were not in writing, and they were not given in open court on the record. We don't know what conversation took place in the jury room between Deputy Diamond and the jurors. We don't know what words Deputy Diamond used to convey the court's message. And we don't know if any of the jurors made any substantive response to Deputy Diamond or if there was any additional conversation that occurred after he delivered the message.
Well, how do we review this? Do we review it as structural error or the automatic reversal, or do we review it to see if it's a harmless error? We're seeing some issues now where some of these judges are making these mistakes. There's no doubt it's a mistake. We've all been trial judges, and we know how to handle it when notes are given. But how do we review it as on appeal here in the Supreme Court?
Sure. It's our position, our initial position, that in this case, because the communication took place during a critical stage of trial, that it would be structural error. If the court does not feel like going as far as saying it's structural error, then we would argue that the error violated Malcolm's Fifth Amendment due process right, and that it cannot be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt because we don't know what was said in the message. So essentially, it's our initial position. Under United States versus Chronic, automatic reversal is required whenever there's a communication that occurs during a critical stage. So the question that this court needs to determine is, was it a critical stage when the jury communicated with the bailiff on this, you know, this issue of the deadlock?
Well, what do you do? You know, when I was a baby public defender, the judges used to have trials that went way on into the evening. And I've taken verdicts at midnight as a public defender. What's wrong with just sending the bailiff in to say, come back tomorrow? What's wrong with that?
Well, the problem is you need to have any communications that are between the court instructing the jury need to be in writing. And in this case, the problem arose because they asked a question. It was initiated by a question from the jury. We're deadlocked 10-2 in favor of conviction, and we want advice. Please advise. They asked the court to please advise them. So the problem in this case wasn't just that it was 5 o'clock and it was time for them to go home. The problem was that they had asked a question, and the court chose, instead of putting something in writing after speaking with counsel, the court chose to send the bailiff in to deliver a message, much like a game of telephone where you tell one person, here's what I want you to say to the next person. They convey the message, and something typically gets lost in the communication as you get to the, you know, the third and fourth person in those situations. In Randolph versus State, this court actually identified, sort of addressed this type of issue and when an ex parte communication would not occur during a critical stage. And this court, you know, the judge talked to a sick juror about the ability of that juror to continue deliberating. And what this court said was that that's not a critical stage because the communications were innocuous. They didn't involve a fact in controversy, and they didn't involve the law applicable to the case. And so essentially, the court's analysis in Randolph suggests that if there is an ex parte communication that does involve a fact in controversy or does involve the law applicable to the case, then that would be a structural error. And essentially, in this case, what you have is you have a jury note that's asking the court for advice, the legal question being, what do we do in the event of a deadlock? And the reason it's a legal question is because the court has a number of legal options that it can give in response to a jury being deadlocked. The court can either declare a mistrial, The court has the legal option to offer, an instruction, an Allen charge, essentially telling the jurors that they need to, remember that they have to find guilt beyond a reasonable doubt and they have to, adhere to their conscience. In addition, counsel could have at that point asked the court to find out is it, since there were three charges, were the jurors deadlocked on one, two, three charges? These are all things that require legal analysis. It's a legal question, and counsel needed an opportunity to be present.
So when the facts became known the next day after the verdicts were read, did anybody interview Deputy Diamond or call him to the stand to ask what communications he had with the jury and what he was told by the judge and what he told them?
Unfortunately, it doesn't appear that that happened. The judge simply made the call that, look, this wasn't a legal question, so therefore I did not have to include you in the decision.
Did anybody ask for the opportunity
to call
the deputy? Or did anybody interview any jurors to determine what the deputy said to them?
What we do know is that at the point where the attorneys were allowed to speak to the jury, there was a representation made to our trial attorneys that they had attempted again to communicate that there was a deadlock and they had asked for advice at that point, but that apparently never made it to the judge. That whatever was just shared with the bailiff was not shared with the judge.
No motion for new trial?
There was a motion for a new trial filed, and those representations were included. Counsel put that on the record for the court. The court had all of that, and when the court ultimately decided that she wasn't going to grant relief, it was on the basis of the note itself. She said, looking at the note itself, this wasn't a legal question. This wasn't a request asking to see.
Well, one of the key things that's developed in the jurisprudence you've cited is the concern about what was communicated to the jury by the bailiff.
Exactly.
And what's concerning to me here is that that wasn't developed either in the motion for new trial or at the time that this information was brought to the attention of the parties the next day when the verdict was returned.
Right.
So it makes it very, if the court concluded that this isn't a structural error, but it's to be viewed from a harmless error standpoint, it would be, I think, pretty important to know what the deputy had said to the jury, especially if he went off on a frolic of his own in providing instructions, but our record doesn't show that.
Exactly, and this is the same record of, in effect, what was before this honorable court in the Daniels case. Mm-hmm. And in Daniels, basically the same thing happened. The bailiff went in and instructed the jury in response to their question, what happens in a deadlock? Does everything we've done not count? And the bailiff provided an answer to the jury, and what this court said is we can't assess the harmlessness of that error. And there was no, the onus was, in a sense, put on the judge. And that was the case law in effect at the time that we filed our motion for a new trial. The onus is on the judge to make sure that this is in the record, that this, that whatever communications go to the jury are, that we follow the statute and that instructions are given in writing or instructions are given in open court or instructions are given in a way that the parties can actually evaluate it. And if you look at the Ninth Circuit case, the Frazen decision where the court actually did conduct the analysis and they found the error harmless, the reason they were able to find the error harmless was because the judge had actually written a note telling the jury, look back at the instructions again.
But that decision rejects the notion that it's a structural error. It's going to be evaluated for harmlessness.
That was a case, I believe it was 1984 or 87. It was in the 80s. The Miss Lawton opinion where the Ninth Circuit subsequently built on the analysis from Frazen. The Ninth Circuit has subsequently taken the position that those are critical stages, and they actually identified three different areas that would be critical stages there's a request for re-instruction. That's an example of a critical stage, according to the Ninth Circuit. And there's also, if there's a request to do a readback of testimony, because counsel would need to be present at that time to determine, do we play back the whole thing? What portions do we play back? Counsel needs to be involved in that determination. And the Ms. Lawton court also said that deadlock is an additional situation, and they said, quote, because minority members of a deadlocked jury are especially susceptible to the pressure from the majority to change their views, a defendant should be afforded the opportunity to request that the jury be re-instructed on the burden of proof or on its members' duty to decide according to their own consciences. And the Ninth Circuit did make it clear, not every communication with a, you know, it's, they're not all structural error. What matters is whether there's a substantive inquiry about the facts or the law. And that's exactly what this court said in Randolph when they said that there was no structural error. If you're just talking to a juror because the juror is sick, you're not discussing the facts or the law.
So you place emphasis in this case in the juror note with the words, please advise.
And Foreman Q. It's essentially titled, it's a question. I don't know that Q could stand, you know, for really much else. There's another interesting thing, too. If you look at Nevada's statute on communications with deliberating jurors, NRS 175.451, the areas where the Ninth Circuit has said that counsel needs to be present because it's a critical stage, those are the same areas where our legislature has mandated counsel to be involved either by giving them notice or by allowing them to be present when the jury is instructed. And NRS 175.451 says, quote, if there is any disagreement between them as to any part of the testimony, unquote, or, quote, if they desire to be informed on any point of law arising in the cause. So even by statute, our legislature recognizes that these are critical stages of the trial, and when there's a communication that involves those critical stages, the attorneys for both parties need to be present to make sure that they can advocate on behalf of their client and ensure that that they're not harmed by whatever communication is ultimately given.
The record doesn't develop this point, but are there other instances where your office has been maybe even the state, too, I presume, have not been notified of juror questions
during
deliberations?
I was informed of another instance involving this particular courtroom, a similar issue that's going to be a fast track. I don't know the name of the case, but I've requested, of course, you know, I hope I get assigned.
Did the trial attorney ask for the bailiff to testify?
I don't believe that request was made. I mean, obviously, in trial, things are pretty dynamic.
This makes it tough on us when we don't have we need it in the record.
Right, exactly. And that's why this court said in Daniels that, you know, when you don't have the record, you can't say that the error is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
And we got to, you know, you always got to be, I always warn public defenders, be careful what you wish for, because I was in a federal trial with a number of attorneys where the jury's out for a long time, and that judge made us sit there the whole time. We could not even go back to the office. And those were the days where you couldn't bring a newspaper or sell your phone. And we sat there looking at each other for 3 days. So watch out what you wish for on these issues.
And look what it did for Justice Cherry.
That's right. I didn't win that case.
You're in to you.
So thank you.
Okay. All right.
Good afternoon, may it please the court. My name is Elana Lee Graham, and I am a deputy at the District Attorney's Office representing the people of the state of Nevada. I think as an initial point, what is exceedingly important for this case and any criminal case when viewing errors or perceived errors, the backdrop is the facts of the case. And the facts of this case was that the crime was on surveillance, the defendant was known to the victim, and the defendant's calls, which were played for the jury, were littered with admissions in the type of the defendant describing intricate details of the crime known only to the culprit, calls expressing excitement over lack of video footage, and concern from the defendant over witnesses showing up.
Ms. Graham, why isn't this structural error? Why isn't this just like Batson, where it's so difficult for an attorney to prove that this is not harmless error? Why isn't it structural error so we can just reverse it and let this guy be tried again with a judge who would live up to what they're supposed to do as far as jury questions.
Right, and I think what's important regarding this question is when you look at NRS 175.451, that statute requires district court to bring back members to the courtroom to discuss a response to a note only when the note is requesting a provision on law or disagreement over testimony. And we've mentioned Daniels, and Daniels, just by way of mentioning, says that when the instruction given is correct, such error is harmless. I would point this court's attention to Farmer v. State. In that case, the note read, Judge Goldman, we, the jury, feel we are no longer making progress in the deliberations. And the note back to the jury from the marshal was, quote, the judge said to continue deliberating. And this court found and Farmer that the district court didn't violate NRS 175.451 because, very similar to our note, the jury wasn't requesting a point of law and wasn't disagreeing over any facts.
But sometimes the judge would call the attorneys and say, can I just do that? I mean, in that case, the judge call?
Your Honor's correct, and they can call. But I think what your Honor's focus needs to be on is NRS 175.451 and this court's own precedent that has said only when the note requests a point of law or a disagreement over testimony is that required. I would agree with Your Honor that that absolutely happens, and it could have happened in this case. But even if Your Honors feel that the district court violated the statute, that error would be harmless. I would also point out that in Volume 5 at 824 through 825.
But, Counsel, before we move to that point, wasn't the jury seeking advice from the judge here in light of their factual circumstances? I mean, isn't that a clear import from the note?
I think to answer that question, what we do always with rule of law is to look at how this court has handled those questions in the past. And this court handled that very question in Farmer. When they looked at the note that said, we jury feel we are no longer making progress, that's the same, in essence, that this court said. The note in this case said. And this court has said, when they receive a note that says, we're no longer making progress, or here, we're deadlock 10-2, then NRS 175.451 doesn't apply. And the request to go ahead and keep deliberating, this court found in Farmer, was it's not inappropriate, it's not coercive, it doesn't suggest that a verdict must be rendered. Volume 5, 824 through 825 is when the district court informed the parties. And the state at that site, 824 and 825, said, Your Honor, just for the record, we would have asked that Your Honor do exactly what you did. And the response from defense counsel was, right. That's what defense counsel said after we were informed of the note.
Let me ask this question. I know that bailiff very well, and I know he's an experienced bailiff. He's been with Judge Wallace a long time. When something like this happens, is there any duty on the fact on the district attorney to say, Your Honor, let's have Mr. Diamond testify? They didn't do it, why shouldn't the burden be on the, not a burden, but actually just an obligation on the district attorney to say, let's have this bailiff testify to see if we have a proper record?
Well, I don't know that placing the obligation would be entirely appropriate, but I don't think that it's out of the question for the state to obviously go ahead and do that out of an abundance of caution, because it is the state's conviction to uphold on a challenge. I would point out that in Russian versus Spain, the United States Supreme Court dealt with this, and it said that any ex parte note that would be a violation, which was addressing another federal case, would ignore a day-to-day reality of how the courtroom works. I understand what Your Honor is saying, and I don't think that's inappropriate for the state to go ahead and request that, but I don't know that not trusting the district court's representation to the marshal of, I told him to keep deliberating. Whether there was more or less to that, I think we take that, we trust that, as she is a member of the judiciary who would be reporting information accurately.
But the issue is not what she instructed her bailiff to do. The issue is what her bailiff actually did. So why not have the bailiff make the representation?
I think that would be fine, and I think that Your Honor would get to that analysis if Your Honor's found that 175.451 was violated. But as I answered to the earlier question, the only way we know if that's violated is to look at what this court has done in the past. And when it held in Farmer that note, we no longer feel we're making deliberations, does not hearken or does not come into question NRS 175.451, we don't really even get to what the marshal told them. The defendant also challenges...
Well, unless the marshal said, well, you can negotiate this out, or you can...
Absolutely, and you know, seeing as I said that, of course, it does matter what the marshal says.
Yeah, it sure does.
It does matter what the marshal says, and my point being that in this case...
Why don't you all go home and sleep and see how you can work this out tomorrow, and, you know, any embellishment, frankly, other than you're going home, we'll see you back here tomorrow at 8.
Right, and I think it's important for this panel to understand that the court told the parties at 3:52 that I will not be keeping this jury past 5. The jury, from the record, it appears, was not informed of that. So when 5 o'clock rolls around, is 9 to 5 or 8 to 5 is a typical work day. The jury's probably sitting there wondering, well, it's 5 p.m. I would characterize this note as an update on progress more than anything, and a scheduling question more than anything. And when looking at NRS 175.451, it doesn't require counsel to be present and then talk about, well, let's tell them to come back tomorrow.
Well, the use of the word deadlocked is disconcerting, and it causes me to, when the judge says go back and keep deliberating, that's pretty close to an Allen charge, which
I
don't know about others' experiences, but as a district court judge, caused me a lot of concern.
Right, and I think you also have to consider that this was after a trial that had lasted 5 days. Mm-hmm. The jury had been deliberating. If you count the time that they walked out of the courtroom, an hour and 8 minutes, and in Farmer, the jury actually said, we no longer feel we're making progress. That is, for lack of, I mean, 6 to 1, half dozen to the other, that's we're deadlocked. And this court found that the marshal saying, just go ahead and continue deliberating, did not amount to a dynamite charge such as Allen. And it's not coercive, and it's not inappropriate. And I would say that the facts in this case are exceedingly similar to the facts in Farmer, where this court found NRS 175.45.
Well, maybe you could address another concern of mine. If the court were to say this isn't a structural error, how do you, in this case, send a message to the district courts that this practice is extraordinarily dangerous? Dangerous in the sense that it runs the risk of depriving the defendant of a constitutional trial, and dangerous in the fact that the state may have to try the case again.
What
would be the configuration
of an
opinion in this case that makes it clear that this practice really is bad practice?
Well, I think saying something just like that, but I also think taking a better look at the statute on point that gives the court direction, that tells the court you do not need to call counsel back if it's not a question of law and if it's not a disagreement about testimony. And I think that's the heart of the issue, because that's the law that the court has to look at. And if
why isn't the question, please advise, a question of law?
Pardon?
Why isn't the question posed in this case in the note, please advise?
How is that not a question of law?
Yeah. I mean,
well,
any response given by the judge.
I can answer that in two ways, Your Honor. Please advise in that it's 5 p.m. We haven't heard from you. Should we continue deliberating, or should we come back tomorrow? Another question or another way to answer that could be, if you're deadlocked, then it would be a mistrial. Another way to answer that would be, just go ahead and continue deliberating.
What if it's 5 o'clock and the judge sends the bailiff in to say, do you want to deliberate some more, or do you want to go home and come back tomorrow? Do you need to call the attorneys before you can do that as a district judge?
Well, I think the better practice, and if I may finish, the better practice would be to inform the jury or from the beginning.
You have more.
I understand. Thank you. To inform the jury from the beginning, I'm keeping you here till 5. I'm keeping you here until 6. And let them know that's how long they'll be keeping them. And if you want to or need to come back tomorrow at 10. I think that's the better practice for basically keeping the jury in the dark as to how long we're going to be here. And when you
notifying the attorneys of that you're going to do that, is what you're saying.
Or notifying the jury.
Well, no, I'm worried about notice to the attorneys.
That they're going to keep the jury till 5?
Or that they may want to deliberate further and get chicken wings and pizza.
Right. Well, in this case, what happened in this case is the court told the parties, I won't keep them past 5. It didn't appear from the record that the court informed the jury of that fact. And when you're in a jury trial as a jury and you're going Monday through Friday, 9 to 5 or 1 to 5, and you leave every day at 5, at 5 p.m. you're going to be wondering, is today like every other day? And that's why this question was more about scheduling rather than a substantive question of law. And I'd also point out, in Daniel v. State, even if Your Honors find that this is somehow 175.451 comes into play, then you have to look at the response. And is that response coercive? Is it inappropriate? And I would submit it wasn't, and so that any error there would be harmless. Appellant also challenged the strikes of women that the state utilized. The state utilized 4 of its 5 peremptory strikes on women. The defendant concedes that the state only really used 2 of its 5 because we used 1 for an alternate and they were all female. We used another for somebody who the parties agreed we could strike for cause. I would argue there wasn't a prima facie case established under step 1, but since we just moved into step 2, I understand that was moot. Libby and Ford hold that when you look to a prima facie, you look at peremptories as well as the totality of the circumstances. The state offered gender-neutral reasons for that. Appellant also argued inappropriate admissions of evidence regarding a witness in this case that was not called to testify, who couldn't be found, Akeem Schaefer. There was no statement introduced by Akeem Schaefer by the state. The only thing that was introduced was that Akeem was interviewed, that the state tried to procure his attendance at trial, and then the defendant's own statements about being concerned about Akeem showing up to testify.
Would you address whether Officer Rizzo's testimony violated Manning's constitutional confrontation clause rights?
Is that with regard to his testimony about Akeem or his testimony? Okay. Well, as I pointed out, the evidence that the state introduced was one that was Akeem was interviewed, and that question specifically on volume 3, page 538 was, did you speak to him about the event at ABC? The answer was, I did. Period. What the state introduced from what Akeem, his involvement.
Mm-hmm.
Next, we introduced our efforts to procure him to testify. Then we introduced the defendant's statement that if they don't have camera footage, the only thing they have to go off of is Akeem. Additionally, I'm worried about Akeem. That's all I'm worried about. And third, so my main concern, that's some bullcrap with Akeem. And then the defendant stood up and said, this is a case of mistaken identity. And the defendant questioned Officer Burgandy at volume 4, 651, you actually took Akeem into custody, didn't you? Yes. You thought he was Malcolm Manning. Yes. When there was no statement introduced by Akeem, and when a defendant negates an element of the offense, the state is entitled to disprove that defense because it's the prosecution's burden, and that's what Jorgensen versus State found. So as far as confrontation clause being violated, there was no statement introduced by Akeem. Certainly, the jury would be allowed to make inferences based on what the defendant had to say about Akeem. If the defendant didn't make all of his statements of concern about Akeem, the analysis would be different because it would be more like a relevance question. What's the relevance of introducing evidence about Akeem? Well, everything's relevant combined with every other piece of evidence. You have to look at it as a whole. So there was no statement introduced by Akeem, so his defendant's confrontation clause rights were not violated.
Okay. Any other questions by the panel members? All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to focus primarily on the jury note issue. And the state makes a whole lot about the fact that the court told the parties that it was intending to send the jury home at 5 p.m. Had there been no note and no request for advice, and the jury was still actively deliberating, then sending the bailiff in to tell them, come back tomorrow, wouldn't have been a problem. It became a problem when the jury wrote a note that was a question seeking legal advice and then gave that to the court, and then the court chose to respond through the bailiff without including counsel prior to sending the message. At a minimum, had we been notified at that point, we would have changed the court's mind about how to deliver the message. We would have said, hey, court, don't, you know, whatever you do, put it in writing, you know, give an innocuous message to the jury about what needs to happen. But we certainly would not have said, go ahead and send the bailiff in there, give him a general guideline of what to say, and then hope the bailiff said what the court told him to say. As a matter of policy, it's dangerous to have bailiffs essentially running the show when we don't have a legal record to show what happened. Another thing that the state pointed out was that, well, the jury only deliberated an hour. So, you know, it's likely that they would have just been instructed to come back anyway. Well, that's not necessarily true. This was an incredibly short trial. Although the trial was 6 days long, they were half days. They started in the afternoon. So, in effect, this was a three-day trial. And there was only one issue that the jury needed to decide, even though there were three charges, because the defense that that Malcolm raised was an identification defense. So the only question the jury had to decide was, is this the guy that did it? And if two of the panelists felt strongly that Malcolm didn't do it at 5 p.m., after deliberating for an hour on a very short trial where there wasn't really that much at issue, that should have been an opportunity that we had to tell the court and say, hey, this was really only a three-day trial. There's not a lot at stake, or I'm sorry, not a lot at stake, not a lot at issue for the jury to determine. So we would move for a mistrial. We'd already moved for a mistrial earlier. So, you know, we would certainly have requested a mistrial at that point.
Was the defendant in custody?
He was.
Because that has an effect as to what the judge should do, because a lot of times when I was a district judge, they'd say, well, Judge, we're changing shift now. It's going to be a couple hours before we can bring him up. And, you know, then you're inconveniencing not only the jury but the counsel also. So, I mean, there's so many things here. That's why I have trouble saying structure. I'm glad to examine it on harmless error, but to examine on structure is very hard for me.
Well, the only reason it's structural is because of the nature of the communication involving a request for legal advice. That's what makes it structural, because as the Supreme Court said in Russian, not every communication between a deliberating jury and the court is structural. So what matters is the context of the communications.
Go ahead, Judge. Operative issue, and that's what was given in response. And we don't seem to have that to determine, so it makes our job very difficult since counsel, and trial or not, didn't ask for clarification thereafter. What was said?
I understand, Your Honor.
What would you have us do? What type of, as Justice Hardest asked the state, what type of instruction would you have us give to courts in the future?
That whenever there's a question about the law or essentially anything that falls under the statute, the NRS 175-451, if it falls under that statute or if it's a question that appears to be legal in nature, the court needs to bring counsel into the mix and let counsel know. That should be done as a matter of course. That's what the statute says. The statute says
it,
shall.
It says that, but as a matter of course. Do we then have counsel get a waiver from his client that the client doesn't have to be present if the client's in custody? Because the practical effect, your client's sent back to holding, he's taken out of the cities, he's put back in jail guard, it's going to take, usually it's an hour turnaround. So what seemed to be a simple situation all of a sudden is elongated. The court has to contact counsel wherever they are, contact the jail, bring everybody back together. You inferred, gee, they only deliberated for an hour. It might have taken them an hour just to get the jury foreman. We don't know.
Those are all possibilities. It's it's just that because the communication had to do with one of the key issues, which is, it's a legal issue, and counsel has a right to be there. The defendant has a right to be there. It's a constitutional right that we can't. If he wants to waive it on the record, that would be fine. But that opportunity needs to be had. To secure his rights.
Ms. Westbrook, on a separate but I think related question, do you feel that the Allen charge, so-called, is constitutional?
As approved by our state, the one that our state has said may be given?
Yes.
I haven't actually given that any thought, so I would be... sort of speaking extemporaneously.
Because the result in this case, at least from the dialogue on the transcript, was the state said, well, we would have had you do that, and defense counsel said, right. I'm not quite sure what to make of that.
So let me actually show you what was said in the record.
I didn't remember it quite the same.
That wasn't quite an accurate representation of what happened. Ms. Lavelle said, and for the record, Judge, if you had contacted us, we would have asked you to do just what you did. Then the court responded, well, they had only been at it in terms of deliberation, I think, for about an hour or so. I don't recall exactly when we, and at that point, Ms. Hojat said right to say, yes, they'd only been deliberating, or, that's what she was answering right to. There was no waiver at that point. So I think the state took some liberties in construing the record on that issue.
But even if you were to construe it that, yeah, right, we're just going to give them, in effect, an Allen charge, I just can't think of a single instance where, as a district court judge, this subject came up and there wasn't a hefty debate about the legal consequences of imposing an Allen charge on a jury.
Which is more evidence of why it's a legal question, because it leads to legal debate.
Thank you, Ms. Westbrook.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Graham, thank you very much. I know my colleagues share this view. You both did an outstanding job in your briefs and your argument. We thank you for your work on the case today.
Thank you so much, Your Honor.
Okay.